Well, welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm Ray. I was in the military. He's Jim. He was in the Foreign Service. And how are you today, Jim? You're back in New York, it seems.
I am back in New York after a few days in D.C. It's a beautiful early fall day. Leaves are turning. And when it gets colder, I head off to Arizona because once the leaves are gone, so am I.
Well, the summer is ending here, but not where our guest is right now, because our guest is down under where all the seasons are reversed. His name is Michael Brzozowski. He is the founder and strategic director of the Blue Dragon Children's Foundation, with which I have had some interactions, and my son actually volunteered there for a little while while we were in Hanoi. Blue Dragon takes a very direct approach to combating human trafficking in Vietnam. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's really good to talk to you.
Well, Michael, you know how we normally start in our podcast is to ask the why should we care question. So why should we care about human trafficking in Vietnam?
So it's a funny thing, you know, when somebody tacks that in Vietnam onto the end, because as I see it, human trafficking in one place is human trafficking everywhere. It crosses borders. It affects us all. And it doesn't matter whether it's in Vietnam, in the U.S., in the Caribbean, anywhere at all, it affects all of us. So that's the short answer, that it affects us all. And it's a crime against humanity that we simply shouldn't tolerate.
Well said, Michael. How did you end up doing this in Vietnam?
Well, quite by accident. So I'm from Australia. You might guess by the accent. And I went to Vietnam on a holiday as a young adult. I was in my 20s. Absolutely loved the country. And, you know, anyone who's been there will know it's a dynamic place. It's always exciting. And it's a developing place. From day to day, things are changing. There's always something new happening. Fantastic place. And so I really got interested in the country and its people and its culture. I ended up moving there and again becoming a teacher there. I was a teacher in Australia, so I started teaching in Vietnam in a university. And along the way started to meet street kids in the capital city, Hanoi. I had no intention of starting an organization, but I started teaching these kids. Some of my university students, these young Vietnamese adults, got involved. It was kind of a, you know, let's get together and volunteer and help these kids. Things grew from there. We started the organization, and then we met some kids who had been trafficked. And again, there wasn't an intention. There wasn't a moment when we sat and said, okay, you know, let's become an anti-trafficking organization. But it just developed over time. Once we'd helped one person who had been trafficked, that led us to discovering another young person who'd been trafficked, and so on. And really, once we were in it, once we were, you know, once we understood what was going on, once we knew how to get people out of trafficking, it almost became just a part of who we are. And today, we still do work with street kids because they get trafficked too. But now really our focus is that question of how do we end human trafficking? So it's all been an evolution from start to now.
So what does human trafficking look like in Vietnam? What does the Vietnamese human trafficking problem look like?
Now, that's a really good question, because human trafficking is everywhere, but in every location, it can actually look a bit different. There are some similarities and also some real differences. In Vietnam, trafficking, the way most of it looks is that people are looking for an opportunity. They might be young people. They are likely from a disadvantaged background. Statistically, they're most likely to be from an ethnic minority community. Vietnam has 13 million people who belong to ethnic minority communities, and there's more than 50 distinct communities. They're looking for an opportunity to work, to earn an income, all the things we think, you know, poor people should do this. You should get out there and get a job. And someone takes advantage of them. Someone deceives them. So come with me. I've got a job for you. I know a restaurant you could work at, or I've got a training opportunity. And that person goes with someone who they trust. That person might have lent them money, might have befriended them online. They might know them through their village or through a network. And finally, they are taken to a place where they are enslaved. Some people are trafficked within Vietnam. For example, girls may be trafficked to karaoke bars. There used to be an issue of children being trafficked into garment factories, and that doesn't happen anymore. But 10 years ago, that was a fairly significant issue. Today, the main issue is Vietnamese people being trafficked to neighboring countries, to Cambodia and Laos, and Myanmar, which doesn't share a border, but is across from Laos, and sold into the scam compounds, where you know people are enslaved and forced to scam you out of your money. So that's the messages, the emails, the texts that you get from people saying, "Hey, this is your bank. Send me your password," or you know, those similar scams. So in Vietnam today, that's what trafficking looks like. And I would just add a comment that it's always changing. Come back to me in a year and I may have a different answer to your question. So it's always changing, but in Vietnam, it's pretty much always about people looking for opportunity and being exploited.
How is the Vietnamese government interacting with your NGO and handling the problem? Do they recognize there's a problem?
Oh yeah, that's one of the positives actually that makes our work really possible. In a country like Vietnam, you know, it's really, really so different to the US, that nonprofit scene. Here in Vietnam, it's all about collaborating with the government, like integrating our efforts with theirs. And fortunately, you know, we're not pushing or arguing with the government about, you know, you should do more. They're in the lead. They're doing their best to stop this. The problem is that it's a widespread problem. You know, Vietnam is a long, long country with 100 million people in it. Often it's happening in the most remote areas, and it's evolving quickly. So that's a really good place for a nonprofit like Blue Dragon to get involved and help. And in fact, a lot of what we do, of course, we do rescues, we do a lot of direct work helping people, but we're also working with the government to show them, look, this is what we're doing. You could also do this. And we do find, as we develop successful interventions to prevent human trafficking, the government is interested in that. They're taking it up. So from a nonprofit point of view, like that's the perfect model. We're working out what works. We're showing it to the government, and then they're adopting it. So I'm very optimistic about the future for Vietnam.
One of the countries you didn't mention when you talked about where people are trafficked to, of course, is China, which is right across the border. And I understand that Blue Dragon has a very unique kind of human trafficking mission vis-a-vis China when it comes to this forced marriage issue. Why is that happening? How is it happening? And what are you doing about it?
There's a long, long history there. And fortunately, that trafficking for forced marriages has really reduced in recent years. So I'll just sort of back up and tell you the history there. The very first cross-border rescue operation that we undertook was a girl who was in a brothel in China, and we were able to bring her back. And for a couple of years, we were doing a lot of rescues from brothels in China. But China, like Vietnam, doesn't have a tolerance for trafficking. You know, some countries, and we're seeing that now with this trafficking into the scam compound, some countries have a tolerance for it. They could do a lot more and they don't. When it became clear that there was a lot of trafficking into brothels in China, the Chinese police kind of clamped down on that. And they did it in their way, you know, they didn't make any public announcements. And you just kind of had to realize, oh, wait, this has stopped. Oh, interesting. Okay. But what kind of filled the void was trafficking of Vietnamese people, and I believe from other countries as well, to become married to Chinese men. And that's kind of a function of the family planning policies of China, which limit the number of children that people can have, and then there's a preference for boys, and so therefore there's over time there's become a shortage of girls. You know, China gets criticized a lot for that. I can also understand their need to slow down population growth. So it's complex. There's a lot of nuance in there. And the bride trafficking is a lot more difficult to stop. When it's to a brothel, you know, there's a building, and that in that one building, that's where you've got victims of trafficking. Bride trafficking, it can be there's a woman in one apartment in that town, and there's a woman in a house in that village. So it's a lot harder to pinpoint it. Also harder to prosecute it. Did the woman come here willingly? Are they really married? It's a lot more ephemeral. It's harder to see. Someone's not necessarily even locked in. And then once someone has been sold into a marriage against their will, once they become pregnant and have a child, that person then might actually be unwilling to leave the marriage. They may have been trafficked, but suddenly it's hard to make the decision to go home. So again, sometimes the media will portray human trafficking as a black and white. Someone's been grabbed off the street and they're in chains. And the reality is so much more complex. So we spent some years working on that issue, and we still do. It still happens from time to time. But it's no longer a huge issue. And really what's happened there is the disruption by COVID, during which China constructed a fence between China and Vietnam so that they could manage the border, essentially. And that has made illegal border crossings a lot more difficult. And so that's why earlier when I'm describing what trafficking is right now in Vietnam, I didn't even mention China. And that still does happen, as trafficking also happens to the Philippines, to the UK, and so on. But it's no longer the primary problem that Vietnam is grappling. So you see in my answer there how it really does shift and change, sometimes overnight. COVID changed human trafficking overnight, from that bride trafficking to China to scam compounds in Cambodia, and then up into Myanmar and Laos.
So you mentioned that the Vietnamese government has been very cooperative, is anxious to work with you, but that also Blue Dragon does rescues. So how does that work? Do you work with the government to conduct these rescues, or they outsource it to you, or what?
Sure. Now, here's the part where I can give some information, and some things I have to be a little opaque, but I'm sure you'll understand. So this is one of the complexities of trafficking. A lot of people listening to this might be US citizens, and you can understand the idea that if a US citizen is trafficked into Mexico, the US police can't go into Mexico and, you know, start searching through Mexican homes for that person. Vice versa, a Mexican person is trafficked into the US, the Mexican police can't just start going into the US and investigating. Now, here in Southeast Asia, you've got so many countries with land borders, people get trafficked across them. The Vietnamese police can't go across a border and start investigating in somebody else's country. So it relies on cooperation. And that does happen at times. But I can, from my point of view, it's frustratingly slow. Now, for example, in Myanmar, you have a civil war underway. And that's not getting a lot of media coverage because there are so many problems around our world. But up in those northern states of Myanmar, it's an active war zone. And so who's going to investigate when there's a report of a trafficked person in the Shan state of Myanmar? So traffickers exploit those vulnerabilities. And that's why they so quickly shifted their model of trafficking to China, where there is a rule of law, you know, where the police do take action. And they found, oh, Myanmar, certain parts of Laos and certainly Cambodia, much more lawless. So that's where, again, where Blue Dragon, where we have people on the ground who are able to quickly form teams and go to find somebody who has been trafficked. Now, what we do, one thing I would say is that we respond to calls for help. So we're not going, you know, and kicking down a door and saying, hey, is everyone here okay? We receive calls from family members, sometimes referred to us by government agencies where a family has said, my daughter's gone missing, my son has been trafficked. Now, the Vietnamese police do investigate, but they just don't have that ability to cross a border. So Blue Dragon, you know, when we get one of those calls, we work out where that person is and we'll send a team. And obviously, I can't say much about that and who they are, but they will go and find that person. Now, we're not a raid and rescue organization. We're not superheroes. We're not beating up the traffickers and we're not paying them off. Our skill, I kind of say a little bit lightheartedly, is, you know, we run. We don't fight, we run. We find where that person is. We work out what is their vulnerability. Sometimes when a person has been trafficked, and for example, a woman trafficked into a brothel, she has to go out at times to get her hair done or to do her nails. And there may be a moment where the guards aren't watching. And at that moment, the person can jump in our car, which is waiting and might have been waiting for a week, and just run. And the traffickers don't even know that we've been there. So we find those very safe methods. And, you know, if you look on our website, we've rescued, it's heading towards 1,700 people over these years. And that's how we've done it. If we went in, you know, guns blazing, you can only do that once or twice and then you have to move on to somewhere else. But because we do it quietly and carefully, at very low risk, relatively speaking, we can keep doing it. We'd love to not be doing it, by the way. I every time I talk about our rescue work, I want to add that note that this isn't what we love doing, but we're good at it. We've rescued 1,700 people and we know how to do it. So we feel that as long as those calls for help come, that's our responsibility, is to respond and get people home. Beyond the rescue, you know, once
you talk about...
go ahead.
No, it's okay. I just wanted to ask a question on that. So you talked about mitigating the risk, but there is risk, right? I mean, do these things ever kind of go a little pear-shaped and get dangerous?
Just occasionally. And honestly, I can think of three occasions where things have got a bit dangerous. You know, three occasions when we've brought back 1,700 people is not a bad record. And so that's where the initial question that you asked, in fact, was around cooperating with governments in the rescues. And I have to also say there, we do when we can. But in this work, sometimes just being silent, doing something quietly, is the only way to do it. And so that means we don't always go and let the police know that we're in town. Only if we know somebody there, if we know someone can be trusted. That's not to say that the police are always going to be corrupt, that they're always going to be in on it. The problem is they might be, and we have no idea. And the only way to find out destroys the entire operation. So we don't report to the authorities until we get back to the border of Vietnam. But if we can cooperate with the police, we do. So it's, you know, I look at someone who's a surgeon or works in banking, and I look at what they do and think, how on earth do they do that? How does that not go wrong every time? Well, it's because they've studied how to do it, and they've done it a thousand times over, and they have systems in place, and so that's how we do the rescues as well. It becomes a system that we repeat over and over.
Do you get any support or help from Western or other embassies or UN agencies?
With different parts of our work, yes. So, for example, we get amazing support from the US State Department for our prevention activities, for where we go into villages working with communities to stop human trafficking. Look, from what I've described, I'll tell you endlessly about how we're as careful as possible in our rescues, but I have to acknowledge that we have a higher tolerance for risk than a lot of funding agencies really like. So a lot of the funding for the rescue work comes from more private sources. But from, for example, we've had funds through some UN agencies. There are some really good anti-trafficking agencies within the UN, certainly from the US Embassy in Hanoi, and the US State Department are really, really important partners of our work. We've had, you know, support at times from the Czech embassy, from the Australian embassy, and so on. So those partners are really important, but they do like to look more at the prevention and also to some extent at the aftercare, the psychology, the rebuilding of lives for people who've escaped from human trafficking.
So let's talk about the aftercare. So, I mean, what kinds of things do you have to be prepared for when you're dealing with people who've suffered under these kinds of circumstances?
The short answer, Ray, is everything. Sometimes we've brought people home, or we've brought people back across the border from trafficking. And across the border, they say to us, look, I just want to go home. I don't want any help. I don't even want to hear from you again. And they might be saying that because they want to go back to mum and dad, or back to their family. Sometimes these are married people who've been trafficked, and they might not want anyone to know what's happened to them. And if that's their wish, okay, how can we help you? Here's our phone number. Here's a little bit of money to get your bus fare. If you need anything, call us. But some people will just say, thanks, I'm out of here. Others will come back with us to a shelter. We do have some safe houses. And they might require psychological counseling for months, sometimes for years. They may need medical assistance, certainly legal representation. One really special thing about Blue Dragon is that we have some lawyers on staff, some Vietnamese lawyers, and so they'll help survivors of trafficking to make statements to the police. And when it gets to court, Vietnamese law allows a lawyer to stand in court on the victim's behalf. They don't even have to represent themselves. They don't have to be in court. So they can be at home. Blue Dragon's lawyer is there. So there's a whole kind of array of services. And what we do is really individualized. It's up to the person what they want to receive. And one really important thing as well, I mentioned that we have some shelters, some safe houses. But the best model of care is when you can actually get people back to their community, back to their village, back to their family, and support them there. And a lot of the time that can happen. So you might be thinking right now, but what about the stigma? What about the discrimination? And yes, that happens. And sometimes we have to go back to people and say, okay, you know, this isn't working. Do you want to go back to the city? Do you want us to help you go to another town and get a job there and start a new life? That happens sometimes. But a lot of the time in Vietnam, families do get back together and live, you know, long lives together, and people get back to school or university or jobs, and they just need that support in their home. Their family might need counselling to understand what's happened, because, you know, sometimes when a person is trafficked, the family might think, well, why did my daughter run away? Why did my husband leave the family? People may not understand what trafficking really is. We might need to go to the person's school, for example, and ask them, look, would you look after this young person who they've been away for 6 months, they're coming back now, they're going to need a bit of special care. So when we can get that person back into their own community and support them there, that's where we find the best recovery takes place. So the shelters and so on should hopefully, ideally, be fairly short term.
So you follow up with these people over time, or how do you know or make sure they don't get trafficked again or that they don't suffer severe mental crisis?
Well, that's the glory of social media and messaging apps and mobile phones. For people who don't know Vietnam, it can be a surprise to learn mobile phone coverage in Vietnam is almost universal. It's far better than Australia in terms of coverage and cost. Everyone has a phone. Often they're sort of cheap fake knockoffs or whatever, but that's okay. They still work. So our psychologists, our social workers, we have that access. And again, it's very individualized. So we might have a schedule where we say, okay, we're going to call you twice a week. Or we might say, call us if you need us. One of our greatest strengths is that agility, Blue Dragon. As I describe our work to you, you can kind of sense that we are what we need to be for that person, rather than, you know, we're this program, and if you want to help, then you fit into it. But we're not a training school, for example. We're not a rigid structure that has a start point and an end point. So we can be super flexible. And again, we find that is a real advantage in dealing with human trafficking, because the experience is very individual. One thing to consider, we often think, well, you know, what the help that this person needs will surely be based on what their experience was when they were trafficked. And that is certainly true. But it also depends on their experience of life before they were trafficked. If we rescue a girl who was from a loving family, you know, her parents always cared for her, she always had enough to eat, and then she gets trafficked, her psychology, her well-being will be very different to someone who grew up in poverty or neglect, or who was homeless and then was trafficked. So you have to look at the whole picture of that person's life and not only their experience of human trafficking, which might have been over, you know, 3 months or 5 years of their life.
So I can only imagine that in dealing with this problem, you have some very high highs and some very low lows. How does the, you know, sort of the heartbreak of some of these circumstances, and how do you deal with that yourself, and how does your staff deal with it?
Yeah, it's something that we've learned the hard way, and should have learned a lot easier. You're quite right. You know, I can remember certain times. In fact, the very first time we rescued some people from across the border and brought them home, I remember kind of feeling like, wow, on top of the world here. I can't believe we did this. This is amazing. Some very high highs at times. But when you go looking for someone and can't find them, or when someone comes back and dies afterwards, which has happened a couple of times, we've rescued people who were very, very sick with, for example, one teenage girl who we rescued had cancer while she was trafficked and of course didn't receive any healthcare. And by the time we got her back, it was too late. We've rescued people who returned to Vietnam with disabilities because a teenage girl, was so desperate to escape her captor that she jumped out of a three-story window and will never walk again, lives her life now in a wheelchair. And the heartbreak is really where you say to yourself, wow, I can't help this person. I can't fix this. When you can fix it, when you can change it, that's when psychologically you're okay. Now, this is for us as a rescue organization, but it's actually for anybody who works in crisis, you know, from an ambulance medic to somebody in the military. When you see, look, I can get involved here and I can change it and I can make it better, then you're more able to cope. So really the issue for us is in those situations when we can't do anything to make it better, how do we deal with that? And we need professional psychological care at times. We need to talk to counselors ourselves. And Blue Dragon does make that available to our staff. We always have that offer on the table. Importantly, from day to day, a lot of how we deal with this comes down to our organizational culture. Being part of a team where everybody understands what you're going through, that just instantly helps, you know, with about 50% of the problem. If you feel like you're alone, no one understands what I'm thinking right now, you know, I'm totally on my own in this grief, then that's far, far worse. So that means we've had to cultivate a culture in Blue Dragon of sharing, of being together, and of allowing people to say, I feel awful, you know, I failed. So there's a few parts to that answer, and again, it's an excellent question because it's one that as a charity, where you don't have the luxury of money to spend on things for yourself or things for your staff, and as an organization dealing with a very dark issue, but there's always more to do. You know, there's you finish one rescue, but someone else has already called for help, so it's hard to stop, right? So in that context, we have to look after ourselves.
So this has been a scourge of humanity forever. But as you mentioned, some governments are trying to educate people about the problem. The U.S. requires every embassy to issue a trafficking in persons report that they can. The U.S. can then sanction governments and individuals based on their trafficking record. But I'm concerned that reading what's happening in Myanmar and Laos and other countries, the problem's only getting worse. So where's the disconnect?
Yeah. In Vietnam, we actually talk about, quite boldly, we talk about our mission as being to end human trafficking. Now, the reason that we do that is we have some experience in Vietnam of actually stopping it in certain locations. I mentioned that kids used to get trafficked to garment factories and that doesn't happen anymore. So that was happening from two specific provinces where children were being deceived, thinking they were going into training programs, and instead they were just in sweatshops. It took us about 10 years, but we completely disrupted that. And we not only stopped kids from those areas being trafficked, But at the end of it, the sweatshops also were out of business. So both on the supply and the demand, you know, on both sides, it's completely stopped. We then studied what we did and started taking that to other parts of Vietnam. And we find again, wow, when we do these things, trafficking stops. And what it's about, just, you know, very in brief, is about having a really rounded program in vulnerable areas where there's a bit of welfare to families who are in desperate times. There's helping mums to start businesses, keeping kids in school, and also working with community leaders, with government officials, so that they know how to identify trafficking and so on. That's the short version. Now, if we can stop it in five areas of Vietnam, why can't it be stopped everywhere? That's the theory that we're working on. And so we're developing this, we call it a model. It's not just a set of activities, it's a model of intervention. And we're taking it, planting it in different parts of the country, testing it, measuring it, and showcasing it to the government. Now, we're seeing success. We're a very long way from saying we stopped human trafficking. But we're really optimistic. And I say it, of course, yeah, there'll always be some trafficking. It's, you know, you can never completely eradicate a crime. But we can take it from here where it's a common daily occurrence, where thousands of people are affected, right down to something that rarely happens. So we're really optimistic. Now, if that can happen in Vietnam, then your question is a valid one. What's going on in these other countries? A lot of it comes down to the country's capacity. So Myanmar has very low capacity right now because of civil warfare, and also will. Cambodia, there doesn't appear to be a will to stop human trafficking. They could stop it. The location of every scam compound where hundreds of thousands of people are in slavery, the locations are all known. But the government doesn't have the will. Vietnam has the will. So it's in the end, you know, ending human trafficking globally is not just about knowledge. The knowledge is very important, and we're not there yet. Not a lot is known outside of Blue Dragon's experience here and a few other organizations and governments around the world. Not a lot is known about how to end human trafficking. So we're working on that. But even when we know it, it's then up to governments and communities and individual people to take that seriously and say, well, we're going to end it in our part of the world. So we're working on the theory that it can be done as long as countries have capacity and will to do it.
Well, Michael, if an episode can be both deeply disturbing and uplifting at the same time, I think you've hit that right about right. We're obviously, you know, everybody has to be troubled by the scope of the problem. You just talked about hundreds of thousands of people being enslaved in Cambodia alone. That's distressing. But at the same time, to know that there are people like the people at Blue Dragon who are embarked on this mission is very uplifting. So tell us, where can people follow you? Where can people who want to support your mission, where can they go? How do they learn more about you?
Thank you for asking. Obviously, the website is the first stop, bluedragon.org. We're all over socials. So whether that's Facebook, Threads, Twitter, and so on, the reason that we're everywhere on social media is because it really is a global community that we see we're a part of. At the time that we're having this discussion, there's just recently been a typhoon in Vietnam. And what we're seeing is thousands of people around the world are contributing to our effort to end it. And, you know, a lot of those donations are $10 or $20. But together they create the possibility of change. And that's the Blue Dragon story. It really is about everyone around the world doing just their small part and creating this change. So that's the real message of hope that I carry in me, that human trafficking, as you say, terrible issue, absolutely terrible. But we don't have to be overwhelmed by it. There is a reason to think we can do something.
Well, thank you for, first of all, of course, for what you do and for what your team does. And thank you also for coming on today and helping us to educate our listeners so that they can do something as well.
Well, Ray, sometimes the problems of the world seem overwhelming, but when you see someone like Michael who says, I'm going to do something about it, it really is reassuring about the world.
Yeah, it does kind of restore your faith, at least in some of humanity. I had a chance, as I mentioned before, to interact with Michael and Blue Dragon a bit when I was in Vietnam, and was just so impressed with what they were doing. And of course, at that time, the cross-border rescues into China were a big part of what they did. There hadn't been the fence put up yet. And some of the stories were just harrowing. And again, they had the cooperation of the authorities on both sides of the border. They both wanted to stop it, and but even so, you know, sometimes, you know, just actually getting to the place, oftentimes the local authorities you can't trust, you know, and so the situations that they were in were just, you know, so tough. That's, you know, one of the reasons I was so excited when he agreed to come on.
Yeah, I've seen a few instances in my career. The only one I can think of most directly was I was in northern Thailand, and we were taken to a little hut where there was this enormous pile of garlic and a bunch of women, probably from Laos, who were doing nothing but peeling the garlic day after day, God knows how long.
Yeah.
And clearly they were trafficked.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not our country. We weren't taking the garlic. All we could do is try and embarrass the local authorities into investigating.
Yeah. Well, you know, just I should probably mention, since it came up, you know, we've had a couple of episodes where we talked about this from different angles, or at least different things that Michael touched on. One, of course, we talked about the gaming organizations in the Philippines, the POGOs, back a couple of episodes ago with Senator Hontiveros. And, you know, that was one of the problems in these gaming organizations. They talked about these scams, these online scams. That's actually what happened in those places. And there were people from Vietnam, from Indonesia, from other places that were trafficked into the Philippines and subjected to these, and basically forced to do these online scams. So, you know, it's remarkable to hear about how huge a problem that is. And then, of course, you know, we were talking about Myanmar, and you know, our episode 9 was all about Myanmar's civil war. And basically, it's the war that nobody talks about, because, frankly, people don't really know where Myanmar is. But you think about all the consequences of war, of civil war, and one of them is the utter breakdown in society. You can't combat human trafficking in a place where you can't go from town to town without, you know, you're all of a sudden you're changing from one warlord to the next.
Well, it's breakdown of law and order. So there's drugs, there's guns, there's human trafficking. All the human vices are there, unimpeded. So when you say you don't like regulation, think about that.
Well, all right. Speaking of human vices, tell me some seamy story from your past, Jim Caruso.
Oh. Among my many vices. Well, what Michael reminded me of is that economic desperation leads to a lot of problems and a lot of desire to migrate, as we see in the U.S. all the time, right? So my first tour in the State Department was as a visa officer, a consular officer in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. And it's a poor country, right, on the same island as Haiti, and people all seem to have relatives in Washington Heights, New York. And they're really anxious to go and will do anything to get there, many of them. So my job was to adjudicate cases of whether this is a legitimate person in front of me with a legitimate reason to go to the U.S. And the most amusing of these cases were very young, attractive Dominican women marrying, shall we say, less attractive, older American men. And was this a real marriage or not? Now, how do you decide that?
Yeah.
So the best case I had was, they didn't share a common language, the American man and the young Dominican woman. He was very unattractive, if I do say so myself, and she was a knockout. So I have a series of questions to ask how well they know each other. And rather than answering the questions, the woman whipped out a picture, a bunch of Polaroids of them doing unspeakable things to each other and saying, if we weren't married, would we do this?
Oh, my.
It was Interesting.
Did you have to go for counseling after that?
I'm all better now, thank you.
Good grief. Well, yeah. Perils of the job. What in your training prepared you for that moment?
Almost nothing.
All right. Well, on that note, so thank you for, we just talked about all your vices. Now we know about one. So for Jim and also for Ian Ellis Jones, who is our producer, and please follow him on X if you're not already. He does fantastic work in the geopolitical realm, and his products are getting more and more attention all the time. He's at Ian Ellis Jones. Of course, I'm at Gordian Not Ray. Meanwhile, of course, if you've enjoyed today's episode, there's a lot more out there, and so you should certainly go out to our website. If you're watching on YouTube, then hit the subscribe button. If you're listening to us on a podcast, then please give us those 5-star reviews and subscribe to us there. That helps you because you get us all the time. That helps us because we get to up our numbers and more people find us that way. Wherever you're hearing the dulcet tones of our voices, subscribe. And that's it for this time. But let's talk again soon on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?